Public assistance is designed to ease social inequality and bring dignity to the lives of the poor, but does it strip away their privacy rights, depriving them of that very dignity as it does so? Kiara Bridges is a Boston University law and anthropology professor. She studied the lives of poor women who seek public assistance. She will argue in a talk at UH this evening that the system deprives people without money of the ability to shield themselves from state oversight. She's the author of a new book called The Poverty of Privacy Rights. I asked her to compare the lives of two young women, one poor and one well-off, who are each about to have a child.
The first, probably most important difference is where they will receive their health care. And the person who is a little bit more affluent will be able to rely on private insurance. And as a result thereof, she will most likely be able to choose her doctor, a doctor who she is comfortable with, maybe even have a relationship with the doctor already.
Mm-hmm.
And that doctor, because of our ideas about self-sufficiency and economic self-sufficiency particularly, will have ideas about the woman in front of him or her. And so he or she will likely think that there's not too much pathology going on, at least not socially. This person is self-sufficient, so we don't have to assume that there's something, you know, wrong with her, you know, ethically, morally, behaviorally.
Mm-hmm.
And the care that she will receive will be reflective of that. And most of the care will be directed towards her physical health, the health of her fetus, making sure that she has a healthy pregnancy, physiologically speaking, et cetera. However, with a person who is not affluent, the poor person, she will most likely have to rely on public insurance, Medicaid in this country, in order to get health care for her pregnancy and to get prenatal care. She will most likely have to go to a public hospital or public clinic to receive that care. And as a condition of Medicaid receipt, in most of the country, most of the states in the union, it requires an extensive interrogation of things that exceed the health of a woman's physical body.
Mm-hmm.
The information required of poor women exceeds information relating to her fetus's health, physical health. And so basically the context in which a woman lived her life is open up for surveillance, regulation, and potential punishment.
Would
so
you be asked...
Whereas the affluent woman will not be asked questions about the health of her relationship or any sexual or domestic violence that she might have experienced in the past, any past addiction to controlled substances, all of that is going to be interrogated with respect to the poor woman. It's going to be recorded. It's going to be the stuff of future interventions by Child Protective Services or social workers, et cetera. So that's the primary difference between the rich and the poor in this country.
You might get questions like, how many sexual partners have you ever had a problem with alcohol or drug addiction? The questions might get pretty intrusive and personal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, so poor women are expected to basically tell every intimate detail about their life, you know, ranging from sexual partners, ranging from contact that you might have had with, you know, police in terms of arrest and any homelessness that you might have experienced, but also just like very just intimate details in terms of like, how often do you eat sugary cereals? And how often do you exercise, and how much exercise do you get a day? And so, like, these sort of questions are things that I don't mind telling, you know, my husband or my sister, but when it's required from state actors who really don't have a fiduciary duty to the person who has to answer the questions, but rather has this duty to report to the state, it becomes much more insidious and much more dangerous. And it makes the person who has to answer those questions much more vulnerable to state intervention and regulation.
Are you able to insist that it be, do you get some assurances that it's going to be kept confidential? Are you able to stipulate that?
Well, you know, there are guards that would prevent the sharing of information to third parties. However, there are exceptions to those guards that have been put in place. And I like to think about this program, it's called Operation Talon, where the database of food stamp recipients is run against database of persons with outstanding warrants. And those folks who are both on both databases will receive a pretextual letter telling them that there is an issue with their food stamps. It's a lie. There is no issue with their food stamps. And so when they come down to an office to sort of fix the problem, they're arrested because they have an outstanding warrant. So we have these exceptions to these privacy protections that allow for the sharing of information in the interest of, you know, crime prevention or crime solving. And what that does is make the poor vulnerable to having their information shared among various agencies. And again, this is not something that would happen to those with private insurance, those who are affluent, because of the government doesn't have their information in the first instance. Their private doctor does.
Kira, what you just described sounds to me like sort of a government-sanctioned deception of clients, right?
So, yeah, I mean, it's very, I mean, it's not even an exaggeration to say that it's deception. It's a lie. There's a pretextual letter. There is no issue with the food stamps. How the only reason why the poor individuals receive this letter is because they have an outstanding warrant, and they're using their receipt of benefits as a carrot to attract them in to this trap, essentially, where they're arrested and the criminal justice goals of the government can be vindicated.
Has that particular practice been subjected to a legal challenge?
You know, I'm actually not sure. I do know that it's a longstanding practice, and I imagine that if it was to be struck down, it would have been struck down already. I don't have the numbers right in front of me right now, but I believe it's in the tens of thousands of people have been arrested under this program since it was first implemented.
Because, I mean, I'm not an attorney, but you would think that that would have a great deal of trouble passing legal muster. But then,
well, that's the entire point of my second book, is that the things that we think are illegal, the things that we think we have rights to, the things that we think that our Constitution absolutely would not sanction, when you're poor, all of those ideas about propriety and legality and constitutionality are thrown out of the window. The poor are subjected to legal, like perfectly legal invasions of their privacy that the wealthy would balk at, that they would be outraged by. However, for example, the poor, as a condition of receiving benefits, have to allow an inspector to just walk through their home, look through their bedroom drawers, look in their kitchen, look under their beds, you know, for any sort of sign that they're actually not eligible for the benefits. Now, the wealthy receive public benefits all the time. For example, we have mortgage interest deductions, and that we should understand that as a benefit because the government has decided to give us something in exchange for our having paid a mortgage interest over the course of a year. I mean, can we imagine what would happen if the government decided that it had the right or the privilege to enter our home just to make sure that we're living there, just to make sure that the house is to the government's liking. The rich would balk at the sort of invasions that the poor have to endure by virtue of their poverty. And it's perfectly legal. It's perfectly constitutional. These programs have been challenged in court, and some of these cases have gone all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has sanctioned them as perfectly consistent with the Constitution.
Kara, in the course of your research, you've undoubtedly talked to women who feel the effects, women in poverty who have to deal with these kinds of scrutiny. What kind of things do they tell you?
Well, so on the more pessimistic side, or what made me pessimistic was the amount of resignation that a lot of poor people have. Just the idea that this is what it is, you know, when you're poor and you have to turn to the state for assistance, or if you're poor and you live in certain neighborhoods, or if you're poor and you have to rely on public transportation or whatever, like that's just the way it is. This is just the way life is. So I was struck and saddened by the amount of resignation that the people who I talked to during the course of my research sort of exhibited around these things. Like I said, if the middle class, the upper middle class experience, you know, there would be rioting in the streets of America. So on the one side there was resignation, but on the other side there was a sense of, I like to call it resistance. I actually end my first book with stories of very creative ways by which poor people are trying to avoid the surveillance and regulation and punishment that they otherwise would be subjected to. And resistance can manifest in anything from, you know, just refuse it. For example, at public hospitals in New York City, if you receive Medicaid, you have to meet with a nutritionist who basically criticizes your diet without offering you really any good advice on how to improve your diet if you're poor. And so they would just avoid the, you know, when a nutritionist calls their name, they would just avoid them, you know. And so, like, so subtle acts of resistance I witnessed all the time. And then I also heard a lot of women articulate the sense that they're not actually first-class citizens, you know, like they enjoy a second-class citizenship. There's a citizenship that allows them to be have their houses inspected, allow people to question their ability to parent, to subject them to Child Protective Services investigations. They have a sense of, like, this is not the citizenship that their wealthier counterparts have. And so there's a disassociation with the country and the body politic, and their sense is that they're not actually real participants in this country. And that's also very disturbing.
Kiara Bridges, a Boston University law and anthropology professor, will discuss her new book, The Poverty of Privacy Rights, in a public lecture today at 5:30 at the University of Hawaii at Manoa's Art Auditorium. To learn more, visit the Conversations Facebook page.